OTB
AM. Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
And you're very welcome along to OTB AM this Wednesday morning. I hope you're doing well wherever you are in the world. You can leave your comments for us in the comment section if you're watching on YouTube. You can tweet us directly at OffTheBallAM, or of course you can always get us on Facebook.com/OffTheBall. Owen's here this morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very well. You're coping. You haven't told the viewers this week about your agony all week.
I'm in the middle of a root canal.
In the middle of a root canal. What does that mean?
It means that, like last week when we were away, I was waking up in the middle of the night with pain in my tooth. And I'm like, oh, this is not good. I've ignored pain in my teeth for a couple of years now. Like any good Irishman when it comes to their health. Oh, that's pain or a lump or whatever. That doesn't matter. That's normal. And, well, that was stupid, it turns out. So, on Saturday, I couldn't sleep. Not a wink, because the pain was like shooting through my face, like someone was kind of jackhammering on my eyeball. And on Sunday morning, I got an emergency appointment and went, and they were like, this is what? Look at this.
I can actually see the nerves dangling out.
Yeah, flopping in the breeze. And they kind of jammed it full of some like antibiotic and anti-inflammatory and something else to dull it, and then you'll get an appointment for an actual root canal. And my appointment's for next Thursday, and it was okay for a day or two, the bit where she'd fixed it, and now the pain is back to the same level it was on Saturday night.
So. And you've got a full 8 days to go through of this?
Well, I'm actually going to have to go somewhere immediately after the show and go...
A pub?
Well, I've got two options. I've got two options. That old school drinking the whiskey through a straw thing.
Yeah.
Or somebody fixing my tooth, because I just can't go on. I mean, I don't know if you can see me, but I've actually just broken out in a cold sweat.
I've never seen such a cry for help at 7:47 in the morning, but that's exactly what just happened there.
Yeah, it's like, I feel like the Elephant Man. I don't know if you've seen that film starring yes. John Hurt.
You don't look like the Elephant Man just yet.
It feels that way, though. It's like, and, you know, any sort of the touch to the point where you're like, don't touch me. Anyway, a very good morning to you, wherever you are, having your breakfast or stuck in the car this morning. But if anybody wants to...
For healthy teeth, if you're out there this morning.
Yeah, look after your teeth. Tooth decay. If anybody wants to share any root canal story / advice, I'm open to advice this morning. I've tried eating cloves. Apparently eating cloves, like, helps to... Because like a...
What sort of witch doctor are you seeing?
A natural antioxidant. Well, the internet, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
The dentist didn't say, oh, go home and eat some cloves. Or go home and mainline some whiskey. Anyway, a brilliant show lined up for you today. Alan McLaughlin's going to join us after 9 o'clock. He's in the back pages of the newspapers today, having had an apology from the FAI about not being invited to the Republic of Ireland Northern Ireland game on Thursday night. We'll speak to him about his memories of Windsor Park and the fallout from that. We're also going to hear from Jemele Hill, who is one of the most famous sports journalists in the world, basically, after she called Donald Trump out as a white supremacist. ESPN suspended her on the back of that. She left ESPN subsequently, and at the Web Summit in Lisbon last week, Owen sat down with Jemele and had an opportunity to talk to her about the current state of race relations, sports journalism, and a whole heap of other things in the US. That's coming your way at about 8:15. In the meantime, I suspect it's time for us to run through the newspaper headlines.
OTB
AM. Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
I guess we should start with a paper that I have easily at hand, and it is the Times Ireland edition. Fear will spur us on against the All Blacks. Ireland will be driven, says defence coach Farrell. It's mad how occasionally in games we cough up a bunch of soft tries, or teams make easy yards against us. In games where we would expect that not to happen. Mm. And then in the games against the really good teams, all of a sudden it's like, we will die rather than give you half an inch over the game line.
Yeah, it's almost a sign of a great team that we were... I'd almost say those incidences of weaker teams, so say the Italy's and the Scotland, particularly in the Six Nations, say 10, 15 years ago, I would almost be more confident going into those games than I would be now. But obviously against the All Blacks now, I'm far more confident than I would be 10, 15 years ago. And it's kind of as you say there, that sort of porous defence at times. I'm not sure if I want to call it that.
It's a bit soft in various areas and in weird areas, in weird ways.
Or I do wonder if there's an acceptance that you only have a mental capacity to be at 100% for so long. That they do accept to themselves, okay, this week in Carlton House, we're up against, so say in the middle of the Six Nations, we're up against Scotland.
Yeah.
We're going to win this game. We're going to tell the press that, you know, every game matters, and we're going to tell them that we take every game as seriously as the next one. But really, how can you get to the highest point, like emotionally, physically, for every single game in a series like that? Or are they literally just saving themselves for the big ones?
But what's the All Blacks like? They obviously...
Well, the All Blacks is the England or the France game in the Six Nations, the Argentina game.
Oh, no, I mean, what the All Blacks' attitude to every game is, we're going to crush you no matter who you are.
They come from a very different base, though. They come from a base where, oh, God, our baseline is invincibility. Like Gordon Darcy makes that point this morning in the Irish Times, whereas... The Irish baseline is still ratcheting up. Now, I would say it's at its highest point that I can remember in living memory.
The
baseline of standard, where you go into Saturday with a fair degree of expectation rather than hope. Whereas for the All Blacks, it's not just an expectation on a game-by-game basis. It's an expectation over the entire November series that they go up to the Northern Hemisphere and they go back down to New Zealand having won every single game. So I think they come from a different psychological standpoint.
Yeah, maybe we should be getting there, though. O'Neill warns fans on Brady is the Republic of Ireland headline here. So Martin O'Neill saying, be patient with Robbie Brady tomorrow. Asking Brady now to be a complete match winner again after a year out is a lot. Also the news there that Shane Supple has been forced to retire at just 31 due to a hip injury. And Noel Hunt is leaving Waterford Town to go to Swindon Town as the assistant manager. And the two rule changes as reported yesterday in the newspapers has been confirmed by the GAA. So the sin bin proposal will now be a 10-minute layoff for anybody who gets a black card as opposed to a second yellow. So your first yellow would be the bit where the referee kind of goes, is it worth 10 minutes in the bin? No, but it's...
Now that you say that, I do wonder if referees were a little bit cautious of showing a black card, particularly early in the game, because that would mean that that player, the fellow who's got to go to work on a Monday morning, doesn't get to play the rest of the game. Whereas now he gets to go off for 10 minutes and he gets to come back on, so the referees will feel a little less guilt-tripped.
Yeah, maybe. So you'll see loads of sin binnings.
Hopefully, because there should be, given the way the game is played.
The Irish Times this morning. Times have changed. We are genuine challengers to these All Blacks. That's the bit where Gordon Darcy has caught up with the notion that we're a world-beating nation, even if Owen hasn't. Nation.
He kind of.
Just standards high. Don't just flare up for the big occasion.
I wouldn't necessarily say that.
All bite, boot and bollocks, as they would say.
The idea that you can beat Scotland and Italy, as my analogy was there, at kind of half capacity, is the very idea of superiority, is it not? That the feeling that... It's complete speculation on my part, but this idea that they're saying to themselves, it's fine, we'll tell the media that every game matters as much as the next one, but, you know, it's Italy. And really, that is a superiority complex, something that the All Blacks potentially have as well behind closed doors. Or maybe they do respect every opponent equal to one another, the All Blacks.
The teams, everybody in their times are picking their teams as well. There's a lot of similarity between the teams, although Johnny Waterson's picked Josh van der Fleer at 7, which it seems is madness, really, considering Dan Levy was, like, absolutely amazing. Looked like he could play for the All Blacks last week at 7.
We'll go against the very idea of Joe Schmidt's meritocracy as well. If you put in a performance like that, particularly when it's not for the full 80 minutes, you start the next day.
It's James Ryan and Henderson for Gavin Comiskey and Johnny Waterson. It is Devin Toner for John O'Sullivan, Liam Toland and Jerry Thornley. That's the main one. I think everybody's picking Rob Kearney because he's fit, Joe Schmidt loves him, and also... He good, especially in these big games. Black and white is the headline on the front of the Irish Examiner sports section this morning. Andy Farrell and Why New Zealand are defence coach's biggest test. Donal Lennon, Ireland handles Steve Hansen's Murray obsession well. Now for the real thing. Yeah, that fetish that Steve Hansen had for Conor Murray. It was a bit mad, wasn't it?
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a few minutes because there's been a few more comments from Ian Foster, which I think we're going to get to now.
Kiwis ramp up mind games with digs at Sexton and Aki. So let's just get to these digs, right? The Kiwis throwing digs at Bundy Aki saying, oh, yeah, he looks like a real Irishman now, doesn't he? Yeah, he looks real Irish. Like all those Pacific Islanders you stole as 15-year-olds from their parents. Extraordinary rendition except by means of scholarship. Anyway, he had a few years in the Chiefs, played really, really well. But he's been over here a while now, Foster said. I mean, you have moulded him into an Irishman. He looks like an Irishman now, doesn't he?
He also says there will be a couple of our guys who have probably played with him and know him personally. But we're kind of getting used to that.
Assistant coach Ian Foster with the classy move. Classy move. Bundiaki looks Irish. Well, you know, citizenship is an interesting, convoluted thing these days. People move for all sorts of economic reasons. Maybe the harsh realities of the economy of New Zealand. I don't know. Maybe things weren't great there for a while. Maybe he came here for a new life. And maybe we're getting behind our boy Bundy, especially when people like you, Ian Foster, are coming over here and shooting your mouth off. Also, given out about Johnny Sexton. I'm not sure why he says that, talking about just how Ireland needs to stay on the right side of Wayne Barnes this weekend. Foster here. I'm not sure why Johnny Sexton says that. Barnes is a great ref, he says, of a man who they have a statue of in a urinal in a pub in New Zealand because he once made a decision that they disagreed with. Johnny seems to give them referees a bit of advice in the park too. I'm sure he'll carry on doing that. I didn't really feel like the absolute kind of need to show it up them this week. It's like, oh look, let's not shoot our bolt a little bit early here. The World Cup's a year away. We don't want to be peaking too soon. One of the All Black New Zealand pundits in the paper were like, you know, we're not where we need to be. We're here after the World Cup. We don't want to be there just yet. Mm. Whereas we're like, let's kill them now. So we know exactly where we are. Now I feel the need to kill them.
Ian Foster's terrified. He's terrified. He's terrified that, like, if you ever have that idea that a team is superior to you and you need to cling on to every little bit of advantage that you possibly can because there's a likelihood that they might beat you. That's exactly what I'm sensing here from his comments about Johnny Sexton and Wayne Barnes. Like, why else would he be saying that? I really think that Foster is just thinking to himself, crap, is there something in this? Is what Johnny Sexton actually said about Wayne Barnes, is that actually going to have a material impact on Saturday? It's not really the All Blacks way to actually come out and try and stop an advantage like that from occurring.
Oh, it is. They will do whatever it takes, whatever crappy, clammy means of cheating they can do on and off the field, they will do to the point where they can get away with it. Up to and including trying to decapitate players. Oh, sorry, I lost my balance. It was totally, the guy was dipping his head as I smacked it back into the left.
Decapitation
back
is
into the left.
The All Blacks way.
Yeah, Ram Raid. Spanish Star set for Double Desert Delight. This is the race to Dubai has become a two-runner affair with one tournament remaining. Francesco Molinari or Tommy Fleetwood will end the year as European top dog, but they reckon that John Ram is the person that you should be following on the back of the Racing Post. And Black Wednesday, top novice hurdler Black Op makes chasing debut at Exeter. So we see how Black Op goes today. And then there was the lights went out at a race in Chelmsford yesterday, so they've got Black Tuesday as well.
On the back of the Irish Daily Mail this morning, we've got Fear Factor weaknesses will be exposed by Kiwis, says Farrell. Not sure who the Fear Factor is about. It's obviously with regards to Andy Farrell in this.
Ah, look, really? If you're Andy Farrell, you're like, oh yeah, they're a great team. I mean, look, obviously we've got to be in it. You've got to say, like, he is a perfect performer in these situations where he says nothing that the opposition are going to be like, whoa.
No, but I think there is a fear factor around Saturday, and I'm not quite sure if it's actually the Irish fear that's going to be kind of bubbling to the surface over the next couple of days, or that has bubbled to the surface in this morning's newspapers. Really, like, when I say that about Ian Foster, that there's kind of an edge that isn't the All Blacks' superiority edge. I think there's an actual sense that, okay, we actually see eye to eye with these guys. This isn't patronising anymore. This is a real feeling that Ireland have every chance of beating us. But I'm a little bit terrified. That's what I'm reading from Ian Foster's comments. Brady as well, missing the Euros in Dublin wouldn't be right, says David Sned's piece. Back of the Sun is, it's time for us to create new memories. Fit again, Robbie is chasing success. On the back of the Mirror is the same story. Robbie's jump start. Euros hero Brady ready to propel Ireland towards Euro 2020 on home soil after injury nightmare is consigned to the past. You've also got £5 million. Scoo must be joking. So that's David Scudamore getting a £5 million goodbye handshake from the Premier League as he leaves and he's been replaced. We'll get to that. That's kind of leading the way on a lot of the front pages of the sports section in the UK. Susanna Dinage is the new head of the Premier League. Back page of the Irish Daily Star this morning is Where's Wally? Doubts over Ireland coach's future. Steve Walford's role with the Ireland senior management team may end later this month, says Paul Lennon. And a whole new ball game, a step closer. That's to do with the The rule changes that the GAA have confirmed and the mini alterations that we've seen over the last 24, 48 hours. Back page of the Herald is, it wasn't a tough decision. Shane says it was always the Republic, while FAI is sorry for hero Alan oversight. So the FAI has apologised to Alan McLaughlin, of course, the hero of 1993. We'll be speaking to Alan a little bit later on in the show. He wasn't invited to come back to the game tonight, or tomorrow night, rather, between Ireland and Northern Ireland. And back page of The Guardian is, it's the pinnacle. Discovery's Dinnage takes Premier League reigns. And that's also the lead in the Daily Telegraph this morning. Groundbreaker, Dinnage to take reigns as new Premier League chief. Backlash, then, over that £5 million golden handshake for Richard Scudamore. So Susanna Dinnage is the new head of the Premier League.
Okay, so that's your newspaper headlines this morning. We'll get into some of the main stories in our breakfast menu in a moment. Two quick videos to play. An interesting exchange from the press conference in the aftermath of Ireland's victory against Argentina at the weekend. Mario Ledesma, the Argentina coach, here speaking with our own Mauro Trossaniceli. Have a look.
It's difficult for them to be bad two games in a row. That's the only thing I would say, but haven't watched the game. Apparently England should have won, or the TMO was all right. I don't know. I heard stuff, but haven't watched it.
You say it's difficult for them to be bad 2 weeks in a row. Does that mean they have to be bad for Ireland to beat them?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. That's why it's good to have only one woman as a journalist. Don't know. Don't really know. No, don't think so. Don't think so. They already beat them in the United States, cutting a 18-game streak, and they did it again against England, same thing. No. We for us to beat them, yeah, they have to be bad and we have to be really good. For Ireland, maybe a little bit less. So they have to be average, and Ireland good, very good, and you beat them.
I mean, that doesn't suggest that we're equals.
No, it doesn't. I think, I'm not sure, was that part of Ledesma's shtick during that entire press conference where he comes in at the start and he's like, I've got no press officer, so if anybody asks a tough question, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
So I think that was kind of the running theme from Ledesma throughout that conference.
If you couldn't make out what Mauro Trossaniceli was asking there, she was asking whether the All Blacks need to have a bad game for Ireland to win this weekend. He's like, maybe. Maybe hard to know. Okay, so we did an amazing roadshow last night in the Olympia. Most of that will be played out tonight and tomorrow night. A stacked off the ball roadshow in association with Heineken Rugby Club. Paul O'Connell, Brian O'Driscoll, Keith Wood, Alan Quinlan, and of course former All Black Justin Marshall. Here's a small taste of the action. Have a look.
Undoubtedly the most competitive man I've come across on a rugby pitch or in most walks of life. He just wants to win at whatever he's doing. Table tennis, cards, you know, anything at all, a game of chess.
Welcome back to Dublin, to Ireland. So you're
Thank
in
you.
Paris now, yeah. When did you get in today?
No, I'm here since last week. We've 2 weeks off. We've no game for 2 weeks, so it's quite intense over there. A lot of our players have played 11 and 12 games already. So to give them a two-week break, to give them kind of a week off and then a week where they were handed out GPS vests to do their own running for the second week, and the GPS will record it. So hopefully they're not attaching them to dogs or something like that.
He has a copy of that GPS on his phone, and he's up all night watching players and assessing, and he's building up a data of who he's going to eat when he goes back there.
That's not true.
And frightened.
He's actually recording his own data, trying to just beat them all. You know, still burns inside.
How many steps did you take today?
I don't know how many steps I took.
You don't have one of those things on there just to assess that.
Oh, jeez, give me a break.
I mean, you keep playing down the competitiveness.
I don't play it down.
But you're clearly a weirdo.
It's very much under control now. I would admit that it did go too far. I mean, we don't play. I remember playing Monopoly with my missus one time and a few of the people that were living, we had people, when I was young, when I bought my house first, we had people living in the house. I used to love Monopoly. We used to play Monopoly, but I remember one day we nearly broke up. She started selling her properties off cheaply to other people to try and beat me in Monopoly. and we had a massive row. She was in tears. And
For God's sake.
What's wrong with you?
The best man to ever play.
Was it the Limerick version of it?
No, it wasn't. No. It wasn't out back then.
Wow. More of that good stuff coming your way this evening on the radio and News Talk from 7 o'clock today and tomorrow. We're going to be playing a good chunk of that, and then the whole thing will go on social a little bit afterwards. And for more details on our next roadshows in association with the Heineken Rugby Club, check out offtheball.com/events. Now, our breakfast menu, team drama, quotas, Whelan's 85, Irish Arrogance, and All Black Mind Games is the one that we're starting with. So it's mad that Steve Hansen, for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, before the Ireland game, was actually on his radar. I mean, obviously, he's not taking it one game at a time. All he's been thinking about this entire journey has been beating Ireland. He's been talking about how this is the game between the two best teams in the world. He's been talking about the Conor Murray thing. Is he obsessed with Joe Schmidt, do you think?
No, he's obsessed with Conor Murray.
Well, Ireland generally.
Maybe he is. Maybe he is having the internal conversation that we're having externally, which is Joe Schmidt going to be the next All Blacks manager? Does he care about who succeeds him? Does he think to himself,
well, what if he does a better job?
Well, that's it. Joe Schmidt is going to be the guy who doesn't take my job. I'm going to leave, of course, after we win the World Cup next year. But what if Joe Schmidt goes on to win the World Cup in an even more impressive fashion in the year 2023? Does that scare Steve Hansen?
What if Steve Hansen's career, like all sports careers, ends in failure? What if Joe Schmidt actually wins the World Cup and stops him from being that, well, you had to win the World Cup because you had the best players and the whole managerial system and the whole game is set up for you and you can hoover up the best athletes at 15 from the islands. What if he loses? What if that's what his fear is here? And that's driving this mad paranoia that we're seeing from Steve Hansen.
Well, it's got to be based in fear, doesn't it? I think this entire All Blacks complex that we've seen this week just has a niggle of fear throughout it. And the Conor Murray thing, that was weird. My theory is that Steve Hansen really believed that Conor Murray was going to play. So he was kind of like knocking on the doors of the castle for a few weeks. He was like, Conor Murray's going to play, Conor Murray's going to play. And then he had the battering ram ready to go, which was going to be unleashed yesterday or today. And he would have said something like, oh, Conor Murray's only half fit, I knew he was going to play. Isn't that the Irish way, panicking when they have to play a half-fit scrum half? Do they not have anybody else who can play? And then all of a sudden, Conor Murray's not going to play. So Steve Hansen's bluff has been called. There is going to be no Conor Murray. And the very thing that he's become obsessed about for the last fortnight just isn't going to be a factor in this whatsoever.
We just had the picture up there of Ian Foster, obviously, was out doing some press yesterday. Rory O'Connor, I think, is there. I haven't seen the quotes anywhere else. But just to go through these again. So assistant coach Ian Foster yesterday ramped up the mind games ahead of the battle with the world's top two teams by questioning Johnny Sexton's approach to referees and having a none too subtle dig at Bundiaki. Obviously, on Monday, Johnny Sexton had been talking about how frequently Wayne Barnes is an interesting referee of matches and how, you know, Ireland needs to stay on the right side of him. There was great quotes in the aftermath of that Johnny Sexton bit from Eddie O'Sullivan, who was basically saying that he thinks Barnes is whistle-happy and loses control of games. Hopefully Wayne Barnes doesn't think Johnny Sexton said that about him, because he didn't, if you're watching, Wayne.
What does Wayne Barnes think of all of this? Does he say, that guy's trying to wind me up, I'm not going to be wound up, but then everybody's thinking that I am going to be wound up, so I'm not going to get wound up and I'm going to give you every decision that's borderline? Does it work as kind of like double jeopardy?
I mean, surely he thinks that's a country who pisses on me in the pub. No?
Well, hopefully he's seen that. I'm sure he's seen that.
Yeah, I'm sure it's been brought to his attention by some helpful friend of his. Oh, you won't believe what they've done about you, Wayne. Well, I would actually believe it because I'm a referee.
Whoever is working at the Aviva this weekend needs to like just print off that picture of his head in a New Zealand urinal and just leave it on his changing room chair.
This is what I think of you in New Zealand.
Yeah, you can exact revenge in one way, Wayne, and that is by giving every call to Ireland this weekend. Don't let your head be pissed on again.
Foster says, I'm not sure why Sexton said that. Barnes, he's a great ref. Oh, they're so good at the hashtag bants in the All Black.
You see, this is the thing. We say mind games there. I think mind games is a little bit too strong as to what's going on. Maybe it's attempted mind games. And
Johnny seems to give them, referees, a bit of advice on the park too, so I'm sure he'll carry on doing that.
We need like a foghorn for every Ian Foster quote.
Well, it just when he opens his mouth, plays the foghorn sound.
Well, no, the foghorn that would kind of suggest that he's burned somebody, but not really. I'm telling you, this is all part of an inferiority complex which is starting to fester itself within the All Blacks camp. Do they bite back? They're often the first biters when it comes to mind games. Oh. They've bitten back here in kind of a way that has fallen short of the mark.
I don't really understand why the rest of the rugby world doesn't just constantly attack them. Like, why they're allowed to get away with this? Why don't the other countries just join together and go, well, hang on a second here. Why are New Zealand allowed to do pretty much anything they want to do, up to and including having the haka as the last thing before kickoff? It's like, well, it's our house. We play our anthem last. That's what we decide.
Are Ireland fans this weekend going to sing Ireland's Call during the haka?
I mean, I hope not.
It would be comical because the song is so bad. Like, obviously, the England fans last week, that was kind of funny. It was kind of funny. And it would just be very funny if an even worse song was kind of resounding around.
Was it mic'd up around? So could you hear the haka? You know, sometimes they mic it up, sometimes they don't.
Yeah, you could hear the haka. But yeah, you could
also hear, obviously.
You could hear Swing Low kind of a little bit as an undercurrent throughout. So I think we do it.
Wayne Barnes admits fallout from 2007 Rugby World Cup refereeing shocker with All Blacks affected me. So there you go.
I'm not like that. Richie McCaw appearing over his shoulder there is literal and also figurative.
Forever.
Say after 2007, he just kind of looked over his shoulder, and Richie McCaw was just always there.
Just his voice in his head, his internal monologue. The voice wasn't like somebody he respected and really liked. It was just Richie McCaw bitching about something.
Yeah, he doesn't have an angel and a devil over his shoulder. It's just Richie McCaw over one shoulder and Richie McCaw over the other shoulder.
Well, hopefully there's no Richie McCaw influencing him from like 5 yards offside at the weekend. Fosterwood came out about how, you know, Ireland, we're playing a team that's going to work hard and trying to suffocate us with possession. He damned us with faint praise. We have to make sure when we get opportunities to get the ball that we're really efficient at that and that our set piece goes well and we play in a manner that we get a really good chance to attack them properly. In the past, they're a team that likes to hold on to the ball and play multi-phases against you. And when that doesn't work, they'll go to an aerial game. We'll have to be on top of our game in most areas. I mean, obviously, all they do is play crappy one-up rugby and then they kick it, is what he's saying there. That's the translation for his audience back home. It was like, well, I mean, you know, who's going to get the next... Who is going to be part of it? Anyway, we'll see.
Now, Gordon Darcy's also been writing this morning, and it's our second point on the breakfast menu, Irish arrogance, which is an Irish arrogance that I say we should have. He's saying that we should win the game. We should feel that we're better than them, that is the attitude that should prevail in the camp, which is totally right. But like one of the lines that kind of stuck out to me from that Darcy piece this morning in the Irish Times is that he speaks about the clarity with which the team will have prepared this week, even just purely from who's going to have what jersey, that clearing up the Conor Murray thing so early in the week was a huge positive from Kieran Marmion's point of view, that he might have got the clarity, certainly once his injury kind of cleared up, that he was going to be the starting scrum half. And he actually mentions Martin O'Neill and says, yeah, that's not a great way of actually managing a team where you're telling a player an hour before kickoff or 2 hours before kickoff that you're going to be starting the game. Joe Schmidt, when Gordon Darcy was in there, everybody knew from early in the week that they were going to be starting. And that kind of feeds into the idea that if you're not going to train for a full week, chances are you're not going to make the starting team at the weekend. And that's clearly the way Joe Schmidt operates. And that clarity of thought, that preparation, according to Darcy, is kind of set up perfectly for us to go into this game on Saturday and say, no, we expect to win.
I don't expect to win, though. Like, we're 6-7 points underdogs.
But why would the players think that?
No, they don't. But, like, the weight of history is that we've never done it in Ireland. We beat them in a game that was played on the far side of the world from them in the middle of their trips. Like, they were out and wandering around the streets having a good time the day before the game. You could actually see them in their hotel at a weekend when Trump wins the election and also the Cubs won the World Series. Like, it was a weird festival atmosphere.
The All Blacks don't believe we beat them. They really don't count Chicago. We count Chicago. New Zealand don't count Chicago. We've got to beat them again.
They can't. They counted it for 2 weeks. And then they beat
put
us.
It right.
Yeah, and they annihilated us physically and on the scoreboard. And they played really well that day, and we didn't. Sexton went off after 15 minutes. Mm. Like, several of our players ended up being concussed, largely illegally.
Sexton was a hamstring injury, though.
Yeah. No, I'm not blaming them for that. But it's like, let's play a whole match with Sexton at out half.
Or let's play a whole match on the same rule page. Like straight away on Saturday. It kind of goes back to Kieran McGeaney. If you want to box, say you want to box. If New Zealand want to play hard on Saturday, I'm sure Ireland will come to that realisation pretty quickly in the match. And straight away, it's like, turn the tables immediately. Let's make things violent if we have to get violent, basically.
Yeah, like, the difficulty with that is that that's their game, not ours, right?
Why, the game of the best team in the world? Why not, like you say, it's sinking to their level. Why not reach to that level? If you can get away with it, get away with it.
Well, because we won't get away with it, because we're Ireland. We haven't stacked the whole refereeing board with a bunch of people who are like, oh, well, that's New Zealand. That brand is too big to fail.
Maybe comments like Johnny Sexton this week kind of changes that attitude a small bit. Like, it's no bad thing that people are coming out saying, well, do Ireland often get the rub of the green?
No.
But if people are coming out to say that, does it create that illusion, that prowess in the heads of officials? Because people have been saying about it, saying that about the All Blacks for years, and it hasn't changed any officials' attitudes except towards the All Blacks.
So, like, again, this comes down to coaching, that Ireland were not great in terms of giving away penalties for decades, and then Joe Schmidt came in and went, we're not going to give away penalties anymore. We stopped giving away penalties that are unnecessary. We stopped being stupid, because the voice on everybody's shoulder in the Ireland camp is Joe Schmidt, and it's probably like watching a video in front of everybody pointing out your, oh, you've got your hand on the ball there, do you, whatever player you are, why did you do that again? Everybody's like looking at you going, so I don't know. I hopefully, anyway, hopefully we just stick it up to them, and we have a whole year of false hope until we get knocked out in the quarterfinals by
South Africa.
Yeah.
Thing is, South Africa play New Zealand in the very first match of the World Cup.
So if they beat them, there's a chance that we can actually
beat New Zealand in the first match of the World Cup.
And we could end up playing New Zealand in the quarterfinals.
At least we get knocked out by New Zealand. That would be a real sweet end to it all. At least it's not Argentina.
So they're getting revenge. Are we better to rope it up them now, make them feel complacent, lose by 40 points, get them to be complacent for the whole next year, have them be shocked by South Africa in the first match of the World Cup, and then us play them and we be the ones wanting revenge instead of them?
That sounds like the perfect theory. We need to get that memo into Joe Schmidt immediately to say,
we
know we're going to win, just stop, don't do that thing which is winning a game.
So obviously massive controversy for about a day or two in England when it was announced that Wayne Rooney was going to play a game for England against the USA. No such controversy really about the fact that Glenn Whelan's playing for Ireland. His 85th cap tomorrow is going to be honoured by the FAI, and really we kind of need to look at ourselves and our relationship with Glenn Whelan and think how stupid it was that everybody was influenced by Eamon Dunphy and the lie that he had two Lamborghinis or Ferraris or whatever it was, and that somehow the story of Glenn Whelan isn't actually this amazing story of somebody making it all the way to the Premier League from schoolboy football in Dublin and carving out a brilliant career for himself and wrestling every last bit of his talent out to secure a future for him and his family in the most competitive sport in the world and the most competitive league in the world.
Mm.
And like, is that not an amazing story?
It is. He got almost 300 Premier League appearances. We need to talk about central midfielders for Ireland over the last 10 years. We don't exactly have a long list of Lamborghinis, as Eamon Dunphy pointed out. The idea that Glenn Whelan wasn't deserving of his place, really, particularly in hindsight, is a nonsense. It really is. And there was that notion that Glenn Whelan is a waste of space and a consistent waste of space. 85 caps later, as I say, almost 300 caps later, 300 appearances later in the Premier League, I think that paints a vastly different picture to the one that was painted in other circles. Like Robbie Brady this week kind of speaking about that as well, the kind of underappreciation that everybody's had for Glenn Whelan. And people have said that quite a bit about Glenn Whelan, particularly teammates. And I don't know, are this team of Ireland players, when they step in front of the microphones, are they likely to lavish false praise on somebody?
No.
Not really.
No.
They kind of tell it as it is. Like from the likes of your Seamus Coleman's to your David Myler's to Robbie Brady, they all tell it like it is. And for Robbie Brady to come out and say, you know what, this guy's really been underappreciated down through the years, that's not just some sort of patronising nod to a man who's about to retire from the international game. That's a serious, honest appraisal of what this guy achieved and the way he was received by the Irish public. And it's a little bit sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's mad.
It's kind of it's a sad end to his career, seeing him go and thinking how he was spoken about.
When you think about it, like, the generation of Irish players who backboned Manchester United and Liverpool, they were competing against the population of Scotland, England, Wales and the North. The population of players who make it now are competing against all of Africa, all of South America, most of Eastern Europe and wherever else the scouts are actually checking information from. Like the database of players that you can access as a an academy recruiter for players aged between 15 and 18 is a massive global industry. It's not just whoever's playing in the reserve team at Hamilton Academical or whoever is like making the breakthrough at Rangers and Celtic. Like, so fair enough, those players played really well for the clubs that they played, and those clubs were successful in European football. But I don't know how much better those players actually were than the current crop. It's just that they were the best of a much smaller group of players. Like, I don't know, I think that we all need to wind our neck in a little bit when it comes to the assessment of the quality of the players who are currently playing for Ireland. Like, they're not as bad as we say they are. They're in a much more competitive environment than any previous generation of player. And the corollary to that is our expectation for the senior team should actually be a bit higher.
Yeah, so...
Does that make sense?
As a whole, it's possible to maintain the idea that Ireland are underachieving while also appreciating the quality of the players and the environment that they're in.
Yeah.
They're two separate things. They're not necessarily married to one another, and I think that often gets lost in translation. It's actually interesting you mention that, because that is our next point on the Breakfast Menu, the idea of quotas, because Matthew Syed has been writing about it in the newspaper this morning, in the Times. You don't quite often agree with Syed and a lot of what he says. This morning, though, part of me does agree with him. So he talks about the idea of quotas. We were speaking about this yesterday.
Dude was just choked on his cornflakes this morning, watching him go, what?
I think I kind of choked on my own words there, as I was saying it, to be quite honest. He's speaking about the idea that we were speaking about yesterday on the show, the Brexit implications of the Premier League, that there will be a quota of homegrown players, British players in the league, and the implications that would have and the knock-on effects that would have for foreign players in the Premier League, which naturally means less foreign players in the Premier League. And Syed is disputing this idea that less foreign players in the Premier League means better British players in the Premier League. And by extension, we can use your Glenn Whelan, we can use your Irish footballing standards argument here as well, that really, if you cleared the Premier League of a lot of these international players from Africa, from far-reaching places, would the Irish players stand a better chance? Yes, they would, in terms of starting games. Would they? Okay, so Ireland wouldn't be included, obviously, in a new Brexit thing. But basically, in theory, if Ireland players were to be treated as homegrown players, would they have a better chance of making starting teams? Yes, they would. Would they have a better chance of reaching higher standards? Syed's point is that no, they wouldn't. So he cites an economist here, and he talks about the idea of import substitution, that basically businesses, when you take away the idea of foreign competition from them in the market, don't necessarily perform that much better. They have a better access to closer monopoly and things like that, but the idea of their standards being improved because of, in footballing terms, exposure to first team football, is that really a realistic outcome? And Syed argues that that's not the case. Are you going to have a better English national football team because of these new restrictions on foreign players? He says no.
Counter-argument would be what happens in rugby when we stop having Ruan Pienaar. I mean, we all thought that Ruan Pienaar leaving was a really bad move for Ulster, and it potentially was. Last season they didn't have somebody with his experience and nous in the club at their moment of crisis to kind of steer the ship, but what it did mean was suddenly Cooney comes through and gets game time. So
the idea, though, is that he's saying the exposure to somebody like Ruan Pienaar has a knock-on effect on someone like John Cooney. At some point...
But there won't be no Ruan Pienaar. You'll still have your Sergio Aguero. You just won't have, like, the seven players behind him.
And to be fair, he does mention that the visual change that we will see is actually on the benches in the Premier League, not in the starting teams. That instead of Alexander Zinchenko sitting on the bench at Manchester City, it will be whatever, Phil Foden or whoever it may be. That's the material change. So as you say, you will still have that top level talent. So he kind of disproves his own idea there, but it is kind of food for thought that basically, is this what you really want? People have been crying out for this for years and years from an English football standpoint, that there needs to be more restrictions put on foreign players. Is it really? And their argument is that it would lead to a better international team.
Are you saying that we don't actually know what the outcome of Brexit is going to be, and that it has been ill thought out, ill conceived, and a bit of a shit show from the start? Is that what you're saying, Owen?
No, we all knew everything about Brexit from a long time ago, and you're just an anti-Brexit snowflake, Ger.
Yeah. There was a brilliant conversation happening in our YouTube comments yesterday about how
probably happening right now.
We were Brexit parrots, taking our received wisdom from our overlords who are telling us to say Brexit's bad
You're in
the European Federalist State is coming, and we should all bow down and kowtow before it.
You are nothing but Brexit-hating SJW millennial avocado-eating snowflake.
I mean, I love avocado. I'm not going to lie to you. I love avocado. It's great. And the ones in Lidl are only 49 cents, so off you go.
That is good value.
Yeah. Come here. One last thing we want to talk about is the Golden State Warriors. I was reading these headlines. It was like Trouble in Paradise, and somebody retweeted a tweet from Stephen Curry on Twitter from 2009 going, we will get this right, and it has like 40,000 retweets, but I was like, it took me a while to go, what, and then I realised it was from 2009. What's going on here?
So Kevin Durant and Draymond Green, two nights ago, there they are high-fiving.
Green's got 23 is a big number in American sports.
Yeah, some trolls would argue that he's the best 23 in American sport, which is obviously a nonsense. But
Beckham is, obviously. David Beckham.
Yes, of course. So basically, they were up against the LA Clippers on Monday night. It was level going down the home stretch. The ball is inbounded. Draymond Green gets a rebound. They've got 4 seconds left to win the game. And Durant is like, pass me the ball. And Draymond Green is like, nope. Dribbles up the court. For some reason, tries to go right away to the hoop. It's not going to happen. Time runs out. Gets dispossessed. And Durant kind of flips the lid a small bit. He's like, pass me the damn ball. Give me the option to shoot. It goes to overtime. They end up losing the game. The argument continues into the locker room where Draymond Green proceeds, according to reports. It's amazing how in NBA all these locker room discussions end up leaking out in full flow. But Green makes some comment about Durant's contract, which is a bit of a touchy subject for Durant at the moment.
Why?
He's got an opt-out at the end of this season.
And there are
heavy reports he might go to the New York Knicks, who, of course, are terrible at the moment. But it gives Durant this opportunity to actually prove to his critics that he can go to a crap team and make them amazing, because he obviously failed to win a championship with Oklahoma City Thunder, but with Golden State, you know, he joined an amazing team. So there's an element of that. So there is a tense aura around Durant at the moment, and Draymond Green just wasn't happy with his reaction to him, and he got a little bit personal with regards to that contract. So Green got suspended for one game, which I thought was a fairly drastic step by the Golden State.
All right.
So he didn't play last night. The fact of the matter is, they won last night anyway, and they ended up by 29 points.
They'd have come from behind victory, though.
Yeah, I think so. I didn't really watch the game. I just looked at the statistics.
Sluggish start, apparently. And then
But it was against the Atlanta Hawks. So you put him up against a better team. You put him into that game against the Clippers. Would it have even gone to overtime without Draymond? They probably would have lost because, you know, Steph Curry's injured at the moment. You've got DeMarcus Cousins, who's coming back after Christmas.
They got Draymond in the middle, towards the end of last season. Is he the one that...
No, they've had him for... He's been there since the start of this run.
Okay, there was someone they signed who was like a superstar.
DeMarcus Cousins they signed in the offseason, so he's injured at the moment.
Right.
And he's going to... You would suspect he's going to improve their team to an unbeatable level after Christmas when he comes back. But there's complications around how they might change their style of play, because he's a big player. The thing now is that, does this start to fester? Is this the first chink in the armour of the Golden State Warriors? Like, when we talk about Dublin and their four in a row, you often wonder, how has there not been any sort of tension in the camp? Like, surely being sated with winning for so long can only last so long.
Their best player didn't play last season.
Well, there you go. There you go. Maybe that's it. There is kind of more of a ruthlessness to it. And maybe Golden State are showing that ruthlessness by handing down a one-game ban. Like, the idea of going three in a row is a hugely attractive one to these players. They can put themselves up there with that great Lakers team.
Yeah, well, okay, we've got to go. But KD is going to... When will he announce? Like, when do we find out?
Probably at the end of the season. Like, he's contracted to the end of next season, but it's kind of that player opt-out option for next season, as they tend to have in American sports.
All right. So we were at Web Summit last week in Lisbon and spoke to very many interesting people, not the least of which is Jamel Hill, currently of The Atlantic, formerly of ESPN. So Jamel was like the presenter of SportsCenter, which like is this American sports institution. There's a drive time SportsCenter and there's an evening SportsCenter, and it's basically where a load of America's best sports broadcasters have kind of reached the absolute pinnacle of fame and celebrity, because it turns out that they had highlights in a time when you couldn't see highlights anywhere. So if you were a sports fan of anything, ESPN had those highlights every night at 6 o'clock and 12 or 6 o'clock and 11. That
6 and 11, yeah. Scott Van Pelt on 11 and she was on 6.
So Jamel came to prominence in this part of the world, really, though, when she was called out by Donald Trump after she labelled him a white supremacist. You might remember this is all around the Charlottesville, the far-right groups in Charlottesville gathered. Those protest turned violent. She tweeted this: Donald Trump is a white supremacist who has largely surrounded himself with other white supremacists. That's in September 2017. With Jemele Hill at the mic, it's no wonder ESPN ratings have tanked. In fact, tanked so badly it is the talk of the industry. That was his response. And then obviously Colin Kaepernick on the right side of history. We are with you at Jemele Hill. She got suspended by John Skipper, who was the president of ESPN. She was actually interviewing John Skipper at Web Summit. So that was an interesting dynamic to be able to witness backstage. They seem to have made their peace. For what it's worth, they were happy chatting away to each other.
Seemed that way. On stage, it was all kind of laughing and happy and things like that. I think Skipper kind of, she accepts he had to do what he had to do. You know, one man doesn't necessarily make a decision in that organization. There's pressures from elsewhere.
Yeah, so. Disney own ESPN, and Disney are, you know, Disney are Disney. Good bit of reading about Disney there if you want to check their background. Just Google that. Anyway, we picked the conversation up here with Jemele talking about moving on from ESPN's flagship sports center. Have a look.
It just didn't feel like a good fit for me, and so I asked to leave.
Right. And then what happened?
So then after I asked to leave, I went to join an ESPN vertical site called The Undefeated, which focuses on the intersection between race, sports, and culture. And I wrote for The Undefeated, still was doing television, but on different commentary shows people are familiar with, Around the Horn, Highly Questionable, Sports Nation. So I was just kind of bouncing around doing TV, returning to my first love of writing. And, yeah, I mean, I did that up until, you know, September, because I'd done so much at ESPN. It's the best job I've ever had. It's the longest job I've ever had. I was there for 12 years, so clearly it was something I liked about the place, right? But it got to a point where there was nothing left for me to do. There was nothing else I wanted to do. And I thought it was just kind of time, you know, for me to move on. I kind of compared it to a relationship where you may love each other, but you have no business being together.
Okay.
And that's kind of where we were.
That's an analogy right there. So can we talk about Charlottesville? Because that's the moment when, as I say, I think most people who like holiday in the United States, which you're on ESPN, it's the first thing we do. So a lot of Irish people probably know your face from just putting on ESPN. But I think that was the first time when everybody realized who you really were at that point, when it was like, I think a lot of people, certainly a lot of people that I work with, were absolutely delighted to see somebody take a stance in a position like that. And particularly when there was a bit of blowback, that you actually stood firm on what you believed in, and you weren't going to back down off this. So explain to us what happened on Twitter and the response from Donald Trump.
Well, you brought up Charlottesville, and that was, for a lot of people in the States, it was very triggering. And, you know, my mother, she grew up in the civil rights era, and so she had described a lot of what we saw in Charlottesville, except for it was even worse.
In Detroit,
because she was 11 years old when the 1967 riots happened in Detroit. And so she had seen that level of violence. And certainly nobody in the States is naive. We all knew racism existed. But to see, you know, white supremacists, Nazi sympathizers, people even just calling themselves flat out Nazis, to see them take over an American city was troubling, to say the least. Worse than that was the fact that they not only felt emboldened and empowered, but that our own president seemed to have trouble condemning that behavior. And, you know, when you're in sports, and especially working at a place like ESPN, you sort of have to almost distance yourself from being a citizen of the country, because when people tune in to see me at 6 o'clock, they're not tuning in for my political opinions. They're tuning in to hear my takes on the NFL or the NBA or various other sports topics. And so there was a lot of frustration I had built up just being a citizen and watching that unfold and seeing the behavior and tone of our government. And I got into a back and forth with somebody on Twitter, and I just said what it was. I mean, there's a mountain of evidence where that is very disconcerting when it comes to our president and how he feels about certain ethnic groups, how he feels about women. This is all there, public record for everyone to see. And so when I said what I said about him, I didn't really think I was saying anything that was controversial or surprising, because, again, the case had been pretty clear. But nevertheless, it created a lot of attention. It became a huge national controversy. And, you know, he attacked me. He attacked ESPN. And, you know, the White House thought what I said was fireable. I didn't get fired. And so it became just kind of this thing. So whereas before that happened, people would come up to me and want to ask, you know, if I thought Tom Brady was the greatest quarterback ever. Now when they come up and talk to me, they want to, you know, get off their own thoughts about the president and about our government, or just discuss, you know, social or racial issues. So it's really flipped my life in a completely different direction.
Are those people largely supportive?
Everybody's been supportive. I've never had a negative interaction with somebody based off everything that happened. I mean, look, I'm not going to kid you. After that, you know, I got a lot of hate mail. You know, ESPN had to beef up security, and I even had to shut off the voicemail, my voicemail at work, because the messages that were left were so threatening and so nasty. So there was certainly a lot of vitriol that was directed my way, and of course on social media. But the people that I meet in public and talk to, I've never had to encounter any of that. And it just kind of goes to what I've always believed is, like, some of those people that yell the loudest on social media, the all caps crowd, like, they're real good keyboard warriors. They're not going to say the same thing to you in person.
Yeah. What sort of trending letters were you getting?
Oh, man. I mean, I got called some of everything. I mean, a lot of racial slurs, a lot of, you know, negative comments about me being a woman, and just, you know, go back to Africa. Like, you name it. Trust me, I was called it. I was told it. I was weirdly kind of amused and impressed by those who did snail mail, because, like, who the hell sends letters anymore? So I was like, man, you got to be really committed to this racism to send me this snail mail. But I did. I had a stacks of letters. And so it was, you know, it was very bizarre for me to have to go through that. And I remember the Monday after I made those comments, I was going to Monday Night Football to see the Giants and the Lions play. And I actually had to have security, because at that point I had not been out in public. And so I wasn't really sure how people would react and respond, especially when you have a stack of hate mail letters that are calling you a bunch of things and, you know, threatening you and that sort of thing. But again, as I said, my public interactions with people have been fine.
Yeah, it is. I personally can't comprehend why people out there feel that it is an absolute rule that sport and politics have to be separate. And it's quite timely to be having this discussion because of everything that's going on with Colin Kaepernick at the moment, and the way it's you can make a very strong argument that he has been blackballed by the league. But let's not have that argument now. What's your view on Colin Kaepernick and his treatment and the way he's been discussed in public? Of course, and one thing you and Colin Kaepernick have in common is that Donald Trump has taken to airwaves to say things about you both.
Well, I'll say this: those people who want to believe sports and politics do not mix are just being intellectually lazy. They've always mixed, and I think what usually is the case, why people say stick to sports or I don't want them to mix, is because they usually don't agree with the issue that it's clashing with. Like in Colin Kaepernick's case, a lot of vitriol has obviously been directed his way, and then it's become this distraction of an argument about patriotism and the flag and who's a patriot and who's not. But it all boils down to the fact that there are a lot of people who disagree with what Colin Kaepernick do not believe that police brutality is that big of a problem, or they're okay with it. And so because of that, I think that triggers the response, the negative response to him, because if Colin Kaepernick were kneeling for domestic violence victims, I don't think that anybody would be directing vitriol his way, and he wouldn't be blackballed from the NFL. But he's touching on a issue that is combustible in our country, because it is race, it's the police, law enforcement, and now you throw in patriotism. You know, law enforcement and patriotism have become, there are huge ideals in America. And so to challenge either one of those things is going to put you in the crosshairs of a lot of people. I think Colin Kaepernick did what he felt was right. Unfortunately, he will never play in the NFL again. I'd be stunned if that happened. The NFL owners have decided that they would rather keep him out the league than jeopardize any business relationships, any fans, even though, I mean, considering the national anthem, most times you miss it in the broadcast anyway. I think their concerns were always overblown. But 20 years from now, when we look back on this, they're going to have to live with the fact that they blackballed somebody from the league who stood for social justice and tried to give a voice to people who are vulnerable. That person's blackballed. But you look across NFL rosters, you see plenty of players who have been accused of very serious crimes. Mm. Some have been convicted of crimes who are still playing in the NFL. So I've said this repeatedly, it bears saying, if Colin Kaepernick had hit a woman, he'd be back in the NFL.
That's a very interesting point, but it's probably true.
Yeah, I mean, what he's speaking to and who he's challenging, the level of authority, the system that has criminalized and over-sentenced people of color forever, like, those are that's going to make a lot of people feel uncomfortable. And we've seen the NFL forgive players. Not that Colin Kaepernick needs to be forgiven for anything, nor has he committed any crimes. But we've seen that league be a landing spot for people who have done or been accused of some very heinous things. I mean, Ray Lewis was once accused of murder, and he became a leading NFL pitchman years later. And yes, he was exonerated, but the whole point is that that's somebody who they had no problem welcoming him back into the NFL.
You just have to look around at the moment. You look at someone like Tyreek Hill in the league. It is demoralizing to see the sort of the moral graying of what is acceptable and what is not. Like a guy takes to his knee because he protests against police brutality, and yet there are domestic abuse is very strong evidence against some people in terms of domestic abuse, and they're still playing football in the NFL.
Well, a lot of it is that they look at as egregious and as horrible as the act of you know, hitting a woman is, or abusing a woman. They look at that as something that could be corrected. You can sell somebody who has been able to overcome being an abuser and been rehabilitated. What rehabilitation can you sell for Colin Kaepernick? You can't, because you know how he thinks now.
He's an uncontrollable.
Exactly. You know how he thinks. He's not going to wake up tomorrow and say, you know what? I had this thing all wrong. Black people are treated fairly by the police. He's not going to do that. So you can't control his critical thinking. You can't control his mind, and you can't control his outspokenness. So therefore, that's a much more dangerous element to them than, say, somebody who has been abusive. Because, again, you can always sell the story of redemption on that. What is Colin Kaepernick being redeemed from? You can't sell that. And so I think that has a lot to do with why he isn't back in the NFL.
Yeah, definitely. Just another point on this, and we will wrap up. You'll be very generous with your time very shortly. Say if you're of Colin Kaepernick's political viewpoint and you're in that sort of position, I often wonder, do people feel that they should have a duty to go out and actually express yourself? Like, I mean, you take on one hand LeBron James, who is fantastic, he does what he does, but I think that's down to the NBA being a much more progressive league than the NFL. They don't feel as hamstrung as people in the NFL do, because clearly some guy's lost his livelihood because of what he said and because of how he's protested. And then you look at someone like Michael Jordan, who clearly just didn't feel as comfortable saying what he did. Maybe he doesn't believe as strongly as LeBron James. I don't think we'll ever find out, truly. But, you know, Republicans buy sneakers too and all that. And the same goes for OJ as well, who, let's not forget, was becoming a huge global superstar at the same time when police brutality was also a huge talking point in the United States of America. Like, I do wonder, like, should we be more encouraging of these athletes to say, listen, it's going to be okay, come out and talk, because you are the people who represent your communities better than anybody else in the world. Politics and sport, of course they should mix. They're the very same thing.
Well, I think with OJ's case, he had no interest. Michael Jordan was a little different, because his activism, and this is a position I've softened on him over the years, because I used to be very critical. You mentioned the Republicans buy sneakers 2 comment, which he has become famous for. I think it was disappointing for a lot of people, because that was associated with the Senate race in North Carolina with Jesse Helms, who is a notorious racist. And people just wanted Michael Jordan to support his opponent, a black candidate. And it seemed like the most obvious thing to do in the world, not because the candidate was black, it's because Jesse Helms was so terrible, and he was a known racist. And so people were very disappointed that Jordan didn't take more of a stand. However, what I do think Jordan's legacy for black athletes in particular will be is that he showed that you can make a black man the face of a global company like Nike, and it can be not only become profitable, it can change an industry. And that was his legacy. And that's why, even though LeBron James is much more outspoken than him, he is able to borrow from that Jordan legacy and be his own enterprise. And I do think that part of the reason the NBA is progressive is because of LeBron. It's not a thing where they were going to be progressive all on their own. But when LeBron is the most important player in the league, he's the moneymaker of the league, he is the draw. If he feels a certain way about a certain issue or a certain president, then you have no choice but to fall in line, because that's your moneymaker.
Yeah.
So you have to do that. And as a result, because he's their best player and their most vocal player, then you have other guys in the league who follow suit. I mean, the Warriors, Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, so many players in the league are outspoken. And a lot of it is because LeBron has taken the league. Adam Silver is one of the more progressive commissioners out there, but we also can't forget that the NBA, we were talking about Colin Kaepernick being blackballed. They had their own track record in that regard. There's Craig Hodges.
We had him on the show, actually.
Yeah, and Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. They blackballed two players for being outspoken about their about the issues that impacted their community. So I think I'd like to think that the NBA sort of learned from their past behavior, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're not going to go against LeBron James, as he's a global superstar.
Well, what did he make of the Nike ad with Colin Kaepernick?
I thought it was brilliant, and one reason why Nike has been able to be such a mainstay and such a cultural force is that they've always had this kind of go against the grain mentality, and even though people sort of gave Nike credit for being charitable, that wasn't a charity decision, that was a business decision. All that, for all the attention and media focus on all the Colin Kaepernick detractors, there are at least as many, if not more, people who support him. Those people want to buy merchandise too. And more importantly, they want to support Colin Kaepernick. So for all those idiots you saw burning their Nikes on social media, there are 20 people that will easily buy 5 pair each just to compensate and overcome that. And oh, by the way, it's dumb to burn shoes you've already paid for, right? So you have that part of it, and all his merchandise has sold out like crazy.
Yeah.
And Nike knew that. So they made a business decision. That's why he's in that ad. And I think that's an important factor to point out, because people look at Colin Kaepernick as if he's toxic, if he's not marketable. A lot of arguments that people like to make about why he's in the NFL is that he would cost an NFL team or owner money. No, he'd make them even more money because of who he's become.
Yeah, for sure. Last point, we were just watching you on stage there with John Skipper, formerly of ESPN. He suspended you.
He did.
It doesn't seem to be any bad blood there.
No. And it's so obviously during the height of all the controversy with Donald Trump, John Skipper was the president. And so that's how the suspension happened. And, you know, it was obviously when I made those comments about the president, he was not happy with me. And not necessarily because he wanted to challenge what I said or what I believe, but because of the very difficult situation it put ESPN in. We talked about sports and politics. ESPN has unfortunately been in the middle of that discussion because people have looked at the network and said it's too political and use that as a means to attack the network. And so it was right during the hubbub and right during the height of that narrative. And so my comments come out and that certainly didn't help the narrative. And so John was understandably very angry at me. Now, he did not suspend me right away. I was suspended actually about some tweets I made about the NFL and Jerry Jones, and about how if there were so many people that were upset about Jerry Jones saying that he'd cut any player who decided to kneel in protest during the national anthem.
Yeah.
And my position was just like, if the fans, if you're so upset about that, then why don't you make the choice with your remote and stop putting it on the players to have to stand up to these owners when the financial dynamic does not lend itself to doing that. You have the power because you're the fan, you're the consumer. So if you want to support Colin Kaepernick's cause or support the players who you feel like have been pushed and into this anthem policy change, then boycott.
Yeah, for sure.
The word you cannot bring up usually is boycott, not when you work for a network that's in business with all those leagues. And so I was suspended for 2 weeks after that. And, the day before I came off my suspension, John and I had breakfast. We've always had a very good relationship. And I told him then, I'm not going to take back what I said, but I understood exactly why he suspended me. So it's never been any bad blood between the two of us. And we just kind of got a kick out of being on stage together, both two people who have left ESPN and now are on to different and new and exciting paths.
You could have just done the roast of ESPN up on stage.
We probably could have. Hey, look, don't give us any ideas. You know, that might be coming to a stage near you.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. Jamel, it's been great to chat to you. Thank you so much for being so generous.
Yeah, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so Jamel Hill and Owen in conversation at Web Summit. I don't know, good response to that. Huge response, actually. So we'll get some of that a little bit later on. Just going to give you an opportunity to head along to the Ireland All Blacks game all this week on Off the Ball. We're giving two lucky winners the opportunity to attend Ireland against the All Blacks in the Aviva Stadium at the amazing Aviva Fan Studio. This is an amazing experience. Top quality guest analysis, watching the game from effectively a box on the goal lines. It is a sensational day's out. And all you have to do is head over to our Facebook page, like the page and post and tell us who you would take with you to the game. We will announce the winner on Friday. Darren's here. Darren, how are you?
I'm very well, Gerald, this morning, and so is the Ireland defence coach Andy Farrell, because he says he's facing the toughest challenge of his career to date as he hopes to help mastermind a win against the All Blacks. New Zealand have scored 68 tries in their 12 test matches so far in 2018, but Farrell has some experience in plotting the downfall of the best team on the planet. He has been on the coaching ticket of three teams that have done that. He was with England in 2012, part of Joe Schmidt's Ireland setup in Chicago in 2016, and he helped the Lions to a second test victory over the All Blacks in 2017. He's been telling IRFU TV that he knows this is the toughest test a defence coach faces.
They're the best team in the world for a reason, and you know, we get excited. We want to play against them as much as we possibly can, you know. Why? Because we want to test ourselves, and we want to keep on improving and keep pushing up the ladder, as it were. If we could play them every week, it'd be good for us, because it'd be good for our development.
Over the last 9 years, I think only three Northern Hemisphere sides have beaten the All Blacks. You've been the defence coach for all three of those sides. What's the secret?
There is no secret. I've lost against them a lot more than I've won as well. But look, there is no secret. You hear the lads talking about it all week. The lads who've played against them. I read something that Johnny Sexton was talking about earlier in the week, and they're a good side, aren't they? They're going to have their time in the sun, and what they're masters at are making sure that when things go wrong for them, which they do, because they're a team like anyone else, you know, their confidence levels, their ability to stick to the plan and stay on point is better than anyone.
Now, how do you prepare to beat New Zealand? By not thinking about beating New Zealand, according to Jacob Stockdale. He has revealed the hobby that helps him take his mind off the pressures of international rugby. He's been using his downtime in camp to build some Lego.
He does what?
He builds some Lego. Brilliant acting by Owen, who knew that I was going to say that. This is what he will look like as a Lego man via the Sun newspaper.
That doesn't look anything like a Lego man. Let's just...
Hastily Photoshop. Stockdale quoted as saying, "When you're building something the night before a game, that's 3 or 4 hours where I haven't thought about the game." He's also built the Millennium Falcon. Here's a picture of it, which took 7 hours. He's also created a Lego version of the New York skyline and Yoda's starfighter as well. So that is how Jacob Stockdale is preparing to beat the All Blacks. And very, very smart sidestep of a real question, because the media lap this stuff up. They forget to ask real questions and get wrapped up in the fact that, look at him, he likes Lego.
I know, there's no point in asking real questions, because they're going to say, oh, one game at a time, we're preparing for these the way we prepare for Samoa or Treviso or whatever. And it's all BS. We all know that this is the most important game of the year. Grand Slam or no Grand Slam, European Cup Final, no European Cup Final. Beat the All Blacks, and 2018 goes down as a historic year. If you don't, it's like, yeah, we didn't beat the All Blacks.
I heard nothing you said there. I'm just too distracted by Jacob Stockdale's Lego head there. That is, I'm never going to unsee that.
That's an image you're not getting out of your head. Ireland's Kieran Malloy guaranteed a medal after securing a spot in the semi-finals of the EU Elite Championships in Spain. The Galway native won a split decision victory over Vincenzo Arajacci of Italy. The welterweight assured of at least a bronze medal before he fights England's Pat McCormack in the last four. Ireland suffered their second defeat from two games in the Women's World T20 with a 38-run loss to Pakistan. They remain bottom of Group B after the defeat. Pakistan, that's their first win of the tournament. It keeps them in third. The focus now switches for Ireland to a game with India. While in golf, Rory McIlroy could skip the Irish Open in Lahinch as he has detailed plans to curtail his schedule on the European Tour. He's only committed to two of the four events needed to remain a member of the Tour. The 29-year-old said that he was taking the decision to play more on the PGA Tour next season, as it is a non-Ryder Cup year. Callum Robinson says the decision to ditch England and declare for the Republic of Ireland was not a difficult one. The Preston North End man had represented the Three Lions at underage level before opting to switch allegiances to Ireland. The Northampton-born Robinson qualifies for Ireland through his maternal grandmother, who hails from County Monaghan. He says it was a decision he arrived at with little trouble.
I just don't think it's difficult if your close ones want you to do it and play for Ireland. And to be honest, I wouldn't say, like, with England, I know that I feel much more passionate playing for Ireland than I would playing for England, and that's not just me saying it. I think it means more to my mum, which is obviously the closest woman in my life, and I know that it means more even for my family in general. So, yeah, it's not hard if you know that your close ones and even yourself know that you want to play for Ireland.
Do you sympathise with players in that position where they have to make one of the biggest decisions at their career at a very, very young age?
Yeah, and I think it's hard if you haven't got the close ones. They're probably backing you and wanting you to play for Ireland, whereas some families, you might be playing for Ireland, but some their close ones probably want you to play for England, and that's obviously then it's hard on the player because he's split between the two. But I think if you've got, if you know what you want to do and you're nailed on it, it shouldn't be hard enough.
The Premier League's outgoing executive chairman Richard Scudamore is in line to receive a £5 million goodbye gift. Scudamore stepping down next month after 19 years at the helm. During that time, the TV rights grew from income generating £670 million when he joined the organisation, with the most recent deal worth over £5 billion with a B. All 20 Premier League clubs have been asked to contribute to a whip around of £250,000 each to his present. While a referee has been suspended in England by the English FA after asking the captains to play rock, paper, scissors to determine playing ends and kick-off. The incident occurred before an English Women's Super League game between Manchester City and Reading last month. A coin toss, a requirement under the laws of the game, but David McNamara misplaced his coin and decided to use rock, scissors, paper method in place of that. He was suspended for 3 weeks after he accepted a charge of not acting in the best interests of the game. The FA Women's refereeing manager Joanna Thimpson told the Times that McNamara's mistake was a moment of madness. She added, "The referee forgot his coin, and in that moment in a TV game he was really pushed for time. He should have been more prepared. He should have had a coin. It was disappointing. It's not appropriate. It's very unprofessional."
TV game.
What?
It's a TV game. Game's on TV. He's doing rock, paper, scissors.
What would you do in that situation if you had no coin?
I'd go and get a coin. I'm sorry, run over to the sideline there and ask, like, the manager, "I forgot my coin. Give us a coin, will you?" Wouldn't you?
I don't think managers carry coinage in their pockets on the sideline.
He panic thought outside the box.
He did his whole. He was completely unprepared. He completely disregarded his job. He's got one job.
No,
do the coin costs.
No, he's got. You just said coin costs. he's got plenty of other jobs. He's got, you know, to make sure there's 11 players on either side.
It's
he's got
really
to do all sort of stuff.
Yeah,
it was a
free match. He's got one job.
A 3 week ban though for that.
Like the
so
exactly.
Excessive.
It would suggest that there's actually some sort of malice in what he did. That he
maybe the whole story here is not that this is the first time that it's happened. Maybe the 3 week ban is because, like, this guy is, like, phoning it in.
Or maybe it's not. Maybe this guy has legitimately forgot his coin in the dressing room and he's after being
slapped
at
a free... Go and get one. Walk over and go...
He made a mistake. He tried to draw as little attention on himself as possible.
Yeah.
It would have been disrespectful to the late kickoff to go back into the dressing room because referee forgets coin. Get on with it. Come up with some other mechanism.
Rock,
in fact,
paper,
I would say rock, paper, scissors is a better mechanism than a coin toss because you have some sort of control.
You've got no control. People cheat in rock, paper, scissors is really easy. You just wait until the other person goes and you go, oh, you've got the scissors, do you? I've got the stone.
Now so you're attacking the integrity of the player.
So you think it's fair to describe it as disappointing, not appropriate, unprofessional? Do you think they're adequate words to describe what happened?
I think it's bullshit. You can't be pretending to be a referee and coming out and not have a coin. Like, come on.
He didn't forget his coin on purpose.
Ah, well...
No, like, he's more embarrassed than anyone, I would say. He admitted the charge. I'd say the guy's mortified.
Well, and so he should be. Darren, good stuff. Thanks very much for that.
Cheers, sir.
The Homeless World Cup kicked off in Mexico yesterday. Here's Raf Diallo speaking to John Farrell and Tara McNeil, who both represented Ireland at the Homeless World Cup, and the founder of the Irish Street Leagues, Sean Kavanagh.
In a given week, how often would you even have a meaningful conversation with somebody?
Never.
Never. So you're kind of on your own for the most part?
It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Even when you're with loads of people, there's no meaningful conversations. It's just all nonsense.
Mm. Yeah, because I think you mentioned something about, like, social skills and things. You almost need to keep working on them now, and it's
yeah, of course.
Part of that.
It's like I know for me, like, it was a major thing for me, the soccer in itself, to be able to when I came into recovery, I started just playing football with the lads on a Friday, and it was a big thing for me. It took me 2 weeks to get the courage to go down initially to the girls because I had a trust issue with females, yeah. Just that kind of bringing up a lot of stuff, thinking I wasn't good enough, and the lads I played with, I had came through the detox unit with them, so I kind of had a trust in them, but it was kind of a big thing. But once I went down, so I'm 2 years now, like, going down, like, you know, every Saturday in Ireland, still going down, like, you know, even when we came back, like, it's I needn't have worries because the girls are they're just like myself. But you know, when you're coming from that place and you don't know, like, you know, you're coming from, you're trusted to be a major thing, and you're, and like that, you're isolated and, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, the friendships and all, and the support down there, like, from yeah, teammates and staff, like, do you know, that kind of way, it's you can see, I can see, people can see in me like that, me my confidence even down in the pitch, the way I even interact with my teammates even, you know, it's changed so much in, from day one to now, like, you know, that kind of way. Yeah. So,
and it'd be kind of, I guess, that thing of actually just having a normal chat in between, like, the tasty tackles that are going on and everything else, I'm sure.
A laugh, like, we go down there, like, you know, even now, like, when we get together, it's like we've never been apart, but you know, the laugh we do have, like, it's, I have to say, you know, it's great, like, do you know, you're getting to do what you love.
Yeah.
You're getting out, you're having a game, but then you're getting to, like, be with people and, you know, and it's a support network, like, you know, even, you know, if you're not playing football, like, you still have phone, you have people that you can phone, or, you know, like, it's...
it's a completely different change, and change of
course,
circumstance, environment as well. Yeah, just to have, because I guess maybe not everyone's going to actually understand that 100%, because they won't have found themselves in that situation where they're on their own, where they're, you know, I suppose they don't have access to other people. Like,
and, and the girls are, like, everyone is mindful of where everyone has come from. Like, we all have different, you know, like, experiences or what have you, you know, that kind of way, but so helpful, like, do you know what I mean? You needn't have worried, because when you're down there, you're just part of, there's no differences, like, do you know that kind of way? It's like, they're so helpful, you know, that kind of way. Because I know, like, you know, when you're kind of out there homeless, you know, one of the memories for me is being kind of sitting on, you always felt obviously below people, but I can remember sitting on the path one day and saying, like, looking at people and wanting to be that person to be able to get up and go to work in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's fairly, you know what I mean? Like, people say, why don't you just go and get it? The more you're in homes, you sink deeper and deeper, and it's harder to kind of get back out into that, you know, like, you know, and you often hear people saying, you know, if you see someone kind of come down to their level and speak to them, maybe, you know, like, you know, and, you know, sometimes that does help as well, you know, kind of way, because you're kind of like...
Yeah. So did you kind of find the people were generally, I mean, as you kind of talk about people trying to come down to that level, were they kind of generally hostile, or was it almost like an invisibility?
Definitely an invisibility. They'd never acknowledge you, never look at you, never. It was like that you're something floating on the ground that you need to step over and avoid.
Yeah.
And the impact that that has on yourself, on your own emotions, on your own self-worth, is soul-destroying.
Yeah. And obviously you both play in the Pierce Street Leagues, then to have the you know, the street leagues that Sean Cavan has been heavily involved in, and you're able to go once a week or whatever, whenever the training is, and you have that sense of there's something on the horizon at least I can look forward to, I mean, that must be a huge positive.
Even after we played, we still believe that about me and Harry, it's about giving back to what Sean has provided for us, and not enough people are doing it, and not enough people are supporting it. Like, I'm leaving here and going training with the new team that's heading over to Mexico.
Yeah.
I'm going over, I'm funding myself to go over to support them and help them in what I need, because I believe truly in giving back the... Like, Sean may think he knows what he's done for us, but we know in our hearts and how we feel about ourselves because of the football, what he's provided. Mm. It's not just a game of football.
Yeah.
It's not an Ireland cap. It's not winning a trophy. It's self-worth. It's belief. It's figure. As you're playing football, you kind of figure out who you are and what you believe in.
Yeah, amazing stuff there from Raf in conversation about the Homeless World Cup, which takes place in Mexico at the moment. You can see the rest of that good stuff on the Team 33 feed. You can get them on Twitter, and of course they're also on the radio on News Talk twice a week, 10 o'clock on Friday. Evening is probably the easiest time for you to get them. Obviously, the podcast, all that good stuff as well. So, and if you want to get Raf, he's on Twitter at Raftastico for more of that stuff. A reminder, OTVAM is brought to you this morning with Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products. Now, obviously, the Republic of Ireland play Northern Ireland on Thursday night at the Aviva. It's bringing back memories from pretty famous nights a long time ago now, a quarter of a century ago, when our next guest scored an absolute cracker that changed the course of Irish football history. Alan McLaughlin, good morning to you. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'm not sure quarter of a century sounds great. 25 years probably sounds a little bit better for me, if I might.
You can just let that one slide through. Alan, before we get to the game itself, there's obviously been developments in the situation with regards to the FAI and yourself. You issued a statement last night, which is carried in, I'd say, almost all of the newspapers this morning, about the fact that John Delaney phoned you after reading the piece in The Independent at the weekend that you did with Vincent Hogan.
Yeah, that's right. I did a piece with Vincent, and he phoned me. Obviously, it was, you know, I'd had lots of media trying to contact me, obviously, with the anniversary of the goal. Obviously, I've probably regurgitated every year the same story about the goal annually, so sometimes it gets a little bit much. So I decided to hang on till this weekend, last weekend, and say something then. And Vincent had spoken to me and contacted me very early, so I spoke to him first and spoke with him. And he just basically asked me whether I was coming to the game and was I looking forward to coming over to the game. And I obviously was honest and said, well, I hadn't been invited to the game. And then that starts the ball rolling in terms of the FAI actually trying to contact me on Saturday and again on Sunday. And to be fair, I sort of like resisted taking the call. I listened to the voicemails and they were genuine and I could hear them. But I decided to take a bit of time and speak to my wife, speak to my family, speak to some close friends from the squad back then, and before I decided to actually take this step and speak to the FAI on the Monday. And they were very genuine, to be honest. Various people call me, and John as well, made contact just to apologise for what probably the best way to put it is an oversight. So there's not much more I can do about it. It is what it is, and I'd like to think moving forward with significant events that it can be thought about properly, and not just myself. And with what I was trying to say, it was about a squad of players. I played a very small part in that campaign. Although a significant part in the end, but a small part in the campaign. But I classed us all as one squad, and maybe something should have been done with the anniversary of the goal. And it just wasn't about me scoring the equaliser. I think it was generally about the difficult campaign that it was, and the achievements of getting to the World Cup in 94 should have been recognised, in my opinion. But listen, I have spoke to them. They were genuine in what they said to me, which was nice. There's been a development since then. Swindon have appointed a new manager. I found out on the Sunday, late Sunday evening. So, my time this week now is going to be tied up with Richie Wellens and Noel Hunt and helping them between now and Saturday. So the goalposts have changed slightly. So I'll be unable to make the game on Thursday. But the FAI did extend a hand and asked me to come to a future game, which I've accepted. I'm not sure when that game will be. Because I can't exactly say for work with work commitments, but I will certainly be visiting in certainly before next summertime anyway.
Yeah, well, maybe something to mark the 25th anniversary of Ireland's participation in that World Cup next year might be an idea.
Well, listen, it's not down to me to make these decisions. I think, like I said, any organisation should not only recognise certainly what's happening now, and that's the most important thing, is what's happening now and making sure things are working well, making sure the management and the players are looked after and the fans are looked after now. But I still think there's a part to play in recognising the achievements of the past at times. And there's enough people still around like myself and a little bit older and a little bit younger that can remember that. And it's important to... I think, and it's my own personal opinion, not to forget these past achievements. They're never forgotten in Ireland, and they're never forgotten in most of the countries. When you achieve, something that brings a nation together, which it did at that time, and it had done previously in 1988 and in 1990, and then thereafter with other obviously major competitions that we've been involved in. So, yeah, listen, I'm not the one making the decision in the FA. I'm not the one, deciding to. And I hadn't heard anything, but when I'm asked a question, I'm not going to sidestep the answer at the end of the day. If I wasn't invited, which I clearly wasn't, and it hadn't been thought about, then there's nothing much I can do about it. I just have to bat on, but I'm certainly not going to just sidestep the issue, and I never have in my life sidestepped anything. I'm just honest, and that's the main thing, just honest in my assessment, and I do appreciate the fact that they've taken the time to contact me personally and make contact and speak to me. And as far as I'm concerned now, it's dead and buried, and we move on, and we'll go from there.
Which is, I think that it's interesting that you brought this up, because it actually opens up that whole sense of what do we do with our relationship with our successful past, because I don't know if the current management setup are, you know, they want a constant focus from the legends of the game, talking about what it was like in their day when we did qualify as a matter of routine over that 8-year period that you've been talking about, or 6-year period from 88 to 94.
Well, everyone reminisces, don't they? Whether you're in your 60s, 70s, 80s, and you talk about your childhood and your achievements, everyone does that. And it's good to do that. It's healthy to do that. It obviously doesn't help the current team now, whose success hasn't been as notable, because the squad that Martin has in the main is not of the same ilk and quality that certainly Jack possessed. And then latterly, when Mick inherited a squad and of mixed ages and then brought through some, you know, fantastic players that went on to serve Ireland for many, many years. But it's stupid to ignore it. And you know, everyone should draw on that. But to have it churned up every year, I understand it can be quite difficult when things are not going as well as previously. But we all strive and we all that things do improve. And again, it's a long haul. It's difficult. You know, and there has been some success. And, you know, with the size of the country and the available players at Martin and Roy's disposal, it does make it very, very difficult for them to qualify, as it has done for the past few years for, you know, in them situations. They have done, and they've done well. And, you know, they've really, at times, you know, as they were saying in England, battered above your average in terms of, you know, a nation and a group of players. But there will be lean times, and sometimes in lean times, that's when you look back at the times when they were what you would call good times, and it's there's no harm in that. And there's no malice from either ex-players along the way. We're all striving and hoping that Martin and Roy and the whole nation of football, which is the Republic of Ireland, progress forward. But we also understand, as former professionals, that it's not an easy task.
Yeah, I just wonder.
I'm more than sympathetic to that.
I wonder, Alan, if what you've done has actually awoken in the FAI a sense that they actually need to pay proper deference to the quality of what we've achieved in the past. I think David Kelly today, either on Twitter from the Irish Independent or in the paper, is pointing out that there's no pictures of the underage teams that Brian Kerr successfully won European championships with out in Abbottstown, and that we're almost afraid to recognise the strength of these characters, because they've been critical of the current FAI administration, and that actually the current administration needs to grow up a little bit and understand that, you know, we're big boys, we can take the criticism, because these players and former managers are coming from a position where all they want is actually what the FAI wants, and that's for the good of Irish football.
Well, it is, and former players, like you say, are all striving for that as well. And I think it's good for the current squad, and there is talent in there, to be inspired by former achievements at times, and, you know, draw strength from that, and that can be positive. On the other hand, like I mentioned a few moments ago, it can be a negative at times. But listen, I don't get and haven't been drawn into and have no communication in terms of other than what we've had this weekend from previous. I mean, I received a beautiful gold Irish cap many, many years ago, and, you know, that's pride of place in my little room that I have. And, you know, like I said, we don't forget what happened and what we achieved and what we didn't achieve at times. And people should understand that it wasn't all successful with Jack and Mick at times. And it wasn't always, you know, rosy and everything worked and we were unflappable and we were the best team, because we weren't at times. There were some, you know, really poor displays at times. But, you know, everyone was riding on a wave and a crest of goodwill and positive results in the main. But when it's lean times like this, I think it's important that everyone understands. And listen, nowadays, you know, you can make a comment on the game, or I can make a comment on something instantly on my phone to address something or say something. It wasn't the case when back in 1988, 1990, and not so much in 94 either. So everyone's got an opinion and can voice their opinion. But I can't legislate for those in any organisation. I can only run what I do at my work and hope that I'm sensible in what I do, and as a football club and as a person, that at times I have to not make people very happy with me. I have to lead, I have to manage situations, and I'd like to think you're not going to get everything right. And I think just in this situation, people have stepped forward and apologised, and that's it for me. They've apologised for not recognising, possibly not just you know, my achievement with the goal, but the squad's achievement, and particularly 25 years on a significant anniversary. But, you know, hopefully things can improve slightly moving forward. But like I said, that's down to people to decide to make a more positive step forward, or keep it as it is, keep it as it is, and you move forward. But, you know, we'll all support Ireland, and like I said, I watch the games where possible, and you know, fully behind the team and Martin and the squad, because we want them to do well, and it breeds success for everyone.
Yeah, I wonder on a more practical level, is there something that we can even chat about here, or we can learn from here? That I often wonder if the FAI make the best of their resources that they have in the country. And when I say that, I mean great former players, not just from your generation, but the generation that came after, even after 2002, when we had great players who were playing in the Premier League consistently. And of course, one of them is involved at the moment in Roy Keane. But I wonder, even in underage structures, if the FAI, not through any malice or anything, but just through perhaps not making the right communication with certain people, could be doing a little more in terms of practically inviting these sort of people into the fold and bringing them in, and perhaps getting them involved at the end of that with coaching with perhaps underage teams.
Again, you know, I can't speak to the FAI. You know, I can't. I'm not going to comment on that. You know, I've been involved in football since I was, you know, professionally since I was 16. I'm still involved in it today. So, you know, I have a raft of experience and a raft of coaching knowledge and a raft of players into first team now, and that's what I really enjoy doing. And that's where my strength is, and that's where I'm most happy, really, in that area. And I think because I've been in the other area of first team world. So, listen, again, it's up to people to make decisions. There's a raft of, I'd imagine, very good qualified people who haven't played international football, who are equally as adept and of taking teams, and you know, of, you know, maybe not keep drawing the next players coming over. It could be perceived sometimes as a jolly boys outing to come over and an ex player that gives you the actual right to go over and actually be managing this team. It's not. It's them decisions are made like any football club or any association. You live them by those decisions, and sometimes it's right and it works perfectly, and sometimes you have a little bit of a lean time, and it appears that, you know, particularly for Martin, you know, they can only do and work with the squad of players that they have, and they're trying desperately now to find new blood and new stock to try and take it forward. And but any of the decisions behind the scene is down to the structure, and it's not just down to one person. I think it would have to be a collective decision to make to decide which type of staff you want on board, and it should be respected, because I know how difficult football is, and, you know. But like I said, I'm happy with what I'm doing. I'm happy with how things are progressing in my life in terms of my football, and I've never gone, say, cap in hand or picked up the phone and say, you should be using me, or why aren't you contacting me, or, you know, that's not the way things work. If people want to speak to you, eventually they will do, and draw on your experiences, then that's absolutely fine.
It's obviously a big 5 days for the Republic of Ireland. I think every international break at the moment is big for the current team and the current managerial setup. What's your take on how things are going at the moment? Obviously, there seems to be a few kind of elements of light coming to the fruition around the squad at the moment. This week, Robbie Brady coming back to fitness. It's great to see him back in an Ireland jersey. Are you hopeful, Alan, of where we're at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm repeating myself a little bit. It is difficult. Seamus is back, Seamus is a fantastic example of someone who can battle back from adversity and real adversity. He leads on the pitch. You know, I did the commentary on Sunday of the Chelsea Everton game, and I thought he was fantastic in his performance. And he leads by example. Obviously, there's issues. There's obviously the Declan Rice issue. Everyone waiting now to see what he does. And again, the game has moved on. You know, I think you're an 18-year-old from Southampton. I don't know what the situation is there, but, you know, I'd like to think people would be chomping at the bit to get the opportunity to play for Ireland. But things have moved on in terms of your status now, playing for or being selected for England or being selected for Ireland, and where it sticks for you with your own personal development and contractual development. So I'd imagine would differ if you're an England player to an Ireland player. That's no disrespect to Ireland, but that's just the way the world works at the moment. But, you know, I'd like to think, you know, it's difficult. It's a transition time for Martin and Roy, trying to find a balance, getting ready for the Denmark game. It is a friendly, but it is Northern Ireland, so you want to be competitive. And obviously Northern Ireland have had a little bit of a lean spell in the last few months in terms of results as well, after a stunning performance in the Euro. So things haven't really kicked on for them as well. So it's a difficult one. And again, it's difficult, and it's easy for ex-players and to say, well, this is what you should be doing. I'm certainly not in that camp. I just like to see people put themselves forward to play for Ireland, be proud to play for Ireland, And then that gives Martin a base and Roy a base to work with and the coaching staff a base to work with moving forward. But at the moment, it seems that people are a little bit reluctant to put their head above the parapet and declare themselves and give people a chance to build a squad and a team.
Alan, great stuff. Thanks very much for joining us. One last thing that came out from your piece at the weekend, you were talking about checking under your car, that there were death threats in the aftermath of the game. I think most people probably didn't realise things got that bad for you afterwards.
Well, it was just, yeah, I mean, I received a letter from an organisation and quite a threatening letter, and it was taken seriously. So it was handed on to the relevant authorities at the time, and precautions were taken, yeah. And again, I don't know, it might have been someone just you know, decided to make labo, I suppose, and just decide to just, you know, try and scare me. But it was a, you know, quite a tense time. Obviously, imagine I had a young family at the time. And I was keen to make sure they were okay. Eventually, it dissipated, which was good. But that's in the past. Like I said, I mean, I live for today now. Nothing that happened in the past I can change, or nothing will differ. I just have to get on with it. But it was there. It was a credible threat at the time. And thankfully, the world has moved on since then.
Well, look, we look forward to seeing you at the Aviva at some point over the next few months. Thanks very much for taking the call this morning. And best of luck at the weekend. Cheers.
No. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Alan McLaughlin there giving us some thoughts about the story this week. I think that I'm not here to defend the FAI, obviously, but I think that as a sporting organisation, they've come from a situation where they were under siege. A lot of the reasons they were under siege were from bad decision making. The financing of the stadium took a long time for them to sort that out. The decision to hire Steve Staunton, the extra contract for Trapattoni, not having Brian Kerr involved in Irish football, all reasons that you can point the finger, the fact that the league is in the situation that it's in, you can point the finger at them. But they don't help themselves sometimes with stuff like this and not actually trying to get the former players involved at whatever level, be it ambassadorial, be it coaching, whatever they need to do to use the footballing family to help promote the game and grow the game, and so that everybody kind of feels part of the same thing, as opposed to you've got the people on the outside of the football family in Ireland criticising, rightly so, and holding people to account, as opposed to kind of saying, well, okay, come on in and help us. If you think we're doing a crap job, come and help us.
Yeah, what are they afraid of?
Well, being abused, like, you know.
But in terms of inviting somebody in, like, is it a feeling that there may be kind of people on the outside looking in, and if you invite them in, they want to become significant power brokers and they can't allow that to be kind of chipped away at?
Maybe, or I don't know. Maybe it's just that, like, the organisation doesn't have the time and the resources and the ability to deal with all that kind of stuff. Maybe it was purely an oversight.
Or maybe if there is an actual sort of realisation that this sort of thing might help, it might actually change. Maybe that realisation just isn't there, because from everything Alan McLaughlin says there, it seems that the apology from the FAI was genuine. It was a slip of the mind. It wasn't at the forefront of their thinking, looking ahead to the Northern Ireland friendly. They weren't thinking about 1993. And in fairness to them, they did pick up the phone and they apologised to Alan McLaughlin. So I wonder if that's
the start of something.
If that's symptomatic of other areas as well, that perhaps if it's like, if a message got communicated to the top brass of the FAI, that maybe there are other avenues that could be explored that would help your goal, which is everybody else's goal, which is Ireland qualifying for major tournaments, grassroots football in Ireland doing well, the League of Ireland doing well, then maybe they would listen. Maybe they would actually think that, OK, there's actually alternatives here to the ones that we're already exploring.
Like, imagine if at halftime they had McLaughlin recreate the goal with, like, people from both teams and a quick interview with whatever the TV broadcaster is. Everybody is staying at halftime to watch that, and there's a bit of crack around it, and there's a kind of a sense of, okay. But look, at the same time, you can't always be trapped by the ghosts of the past. Like, this is 25 years ago. That's a quarter of a century. There were, like, you would hope, not that many players, unfortunately, who weren't born at the time when that goal was scored in the Ireland team. The vast majority of them were. But, like, there's a whole generation from this is kind of just old stuff that people bang on about.
Old stuff is interesting and important too.
Ad nauseum. So there's breaking news this morning. Fulham have sacked Slavisa Djukanovic and replaced him immediately with Claudio Ranieri. He signed a multi-year contract with the Premier League. Premier League's bottom club, it says here. A multi-year contract with Claudio Ranieri. His first match in charge is going to be on Saturday when Fulham host Southampton. They are going down.
Fulham against Southampton? Talk about a six-pointer immediately.
Claudio Ranieri is not the manager you want in this situation.
Did they get mixed up between Leicester managers? Did they forget it was Nigel Pearson who actually saved Leicester from the brink? The plan would have been to get Pearson in and then get Ranieri afterwards. The thing is, I think we were actually having a discussion a week or two ago about how the relegation race could be terrible, that everybody's just going to end up getting hitched off the wagon and that's it. It's all done and dusted. But in actual fact, things are starting to take a little bit of a turn down there where there's interesting storylines. Newcastle winning games back-to-back. Yeah. Huddersfield getting 4 points from their last two games. Fulham potentially launching some sort of resurgence under Claudio Ranieri. And who knows, the benefit of all of this might be seeing Mark Hughes get relegated.
Well, I mean, look, anything that gets Mark Hughes relegated, I'm all in favour of that. But I just can't get excited for a relegation battle. We were supposed to be excited about the relegation battle last year and ultimately ended up being pretty shit.
Yeah, it did. It did. But that was kind of due to the promoted teams doing a hell of a lot better than we expected. Like Cardiff, of course, getting one at the weekend as well. Like there's, you look at it down there, and it's like the people are hitting form at just the right time to keep things relatively interesting.
Yeah, Newcastle Bournemouth, what a classic that was!
It was classic. It was
a classic of the genre.
Fantastic.
I do think that Newcastle,
it's the Solomon Rondon show.
I do think that Newcastle, like not having the money to sack Rafa Benitez, which they probably would have done in previous seasons, has resulted in them having a manager who stuck through the bad times and is now going to hit their straps and they'll be grand. Like,
so they are in 14th.
Yeah, but that's with 6 points in the last two games. They were bottom 2 games ago.
They're on form.
You get my point, though.
Yeah,
but sacking Djukanovic now is stupid.
Well, I think Djukanovic and Benitez are in different leagues. I think the way Fulham have been playing, like, Newcastle, there was always a sense that they weren't quite achieving what they could achieve in their opening few games. Like, that game against Chelsea, I think, is case in point, where they might have got something from that game, and there was a sense that they were just a little bit too negative, that they actually have some players that are too good to get relegated from the Premier League, namely someone like Kennedy, who I thought was outstanding again last weekend. Solomon Rondon, as I mentioned.
Kennedy's still technically on loan?
Good question, actually.
I think he is, isn't he?
But still, he's going to be with them for the rest of the season. And there are players of quality that can bring them out of that relegation mire. Fulham have one or two players like that as well. They'll need to sign in January. And a name like Claudio Ranieri might be able to bring in a few fresh faces. I'm hopeful for the relegation battle, is all I'm trying to say. I think we might have a humdinger this season.
No, not buying it. Not buying it until like 6 weeks to go and five teams can still
up on the bandwagon then. But I'll be there smug.
Choo-choo!
With my T-shirt saying relegation battle supporter.
From all the way back in early November. A couple of quick comments for you before we get to the biggest story that we've ever brought you here on the show. Celebrity is a platform that should be used to highlight injustice. Kaepernick was very courageous, says Ken, talking about Jemele Hill. Dan says, just want to watch football, not looking for politics. Best of luck with that, Dan. Come to the wrong place. Connor says, never seen such a build-up to a friendly, talking about the Ireland rugby match. God forbid anyone criticises St. Johnny. When it matters, Ireland will be sent home for the World Cup at the quarter-final stage again. If you hate rugby so much, Connor, don't watch. It's fine. It's totally grand. You don't have to watch it.
I like the accent you did there.
This isn't...
Southside accent.
This isn't a Clockwork Orange.
Well, we've established already that it probably has been this weekend for this week for numerous Irish players. But they'll win this test match as a result of that Clockwork Orange experience.
Patrick makes the point that every top team in every sport has a superiority complex. For example, when Kerry get drawn against Waterford in the Munster Football Championship, Kerry expect to win. Except Ireland are not...
Waterford.
In any... like, never have been the Waterford footballers.
This is like Dublin against Mayo.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Except
they
haven't beaten Dublin in a match of significance, and Ireland have beaten.
They have
New
beaten. They beat them in an Ireland semi-final.
We're in this current run.
Horan beat Gilroy's Dublin, didn't he?
Yeah, but like Gilroy's Dublin doesn't count in the current analogy.
Well, they set up the whole thing. They started it.
Yeah.
They broke
2012, wasn't it?
They broke the back.
They were the straw that broke the camel's back. Yeah.
So this is a story that we've been looking forward to bringing you all morning. It's about chess. Take it away, Owen.
Well, thank you very much for passing the baton there. Conveniently, we have up on screen, scandal erupts in World Chess Championship Showdown, and scandal indeed. It was the US against Norway to chess-making powerhouses as Fabiano Caruana was up against Magnus Carlsen, who is actually a name that rings a bell for me. He is the best of the best, but he was up against Caruana, and a video from Caruana's camp leaked. We can bring you a couple of pictures from it. This is the press conference.
Video was published earlier today showing your openings. Do you know about it, and what do you think about it?
Yeah, I'd really rather not comment on this, actually.
That's fair enough. I mean, Magnus, do you have any comments or any thoughts on that at all?
I'll have a look at the video.
What's going on here, Owen? So as you can tell, bands aren't just a part of rugby press conferences. They're also a big feature of chess press conferences. Magnus Carlsen there saying that he's going to have a look at the video, which showed basically the war room of Caruana's preparations. So apparently, now I'm no chess expert, but if a video leaks of very small pieces of information, such as who you're practicing against, then you're in big trouble. So you can see clearly the faces of all the people who's sitting around the table studying the chessboard. You can see a little spreadsheet he's got, kind of like an NFL head coach playbook. You can see up on screen the little patterns he's got laid out. Basically, if Carlsen watched that video, he would be able to figure out exactly the opening strategy that Caruana was going to implement. So not good news.
Spygate. Is this a Spygate?
Well, it can't be a Spygate because the cinematography is so good. Like, Caruana was sitting there and there was a guy over his shoulder just, like, filming. And he's like, I wonder who actually was the spy there. It's probably the guy over your shoulder doing that cool, hip camera shot.
Okay.
And so...
what's the scandal?
Somebody basically messed up big time by publishing this video.
In advance of the game?
In advance of the game.
Okay. So, human error.
Human error.
Minor scandal.
It's like leaving a coin in the dressing room. Human error.
Storm in a teacup. 3 weeks suspension.
3 week suspension.
There you go.
Disrespectful to the sport.
That's our lot for today. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 7:45. Tonight is Wednesday night, obviously. Wednesday Night Rugby is a very special Wednesday Night Rugby because it's going to be largely the highlights from last night's show. Paul O'Connell, Brian O'Driscoll, Keith Wood, Justin Marshall, and of course Alan Quinlan helping to preview Ireland against the All Blacks on Saturday evening. So that's from 7 o'clock tonight on News Talk. We'll be back tomorrow morning, as I said, at 7:45. Until then, from myself and Owen, good luck.
OTB AM.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.